it isn't just an All Ireland project, because we are bringing in large elements of East, West and GB, simply because over the last 10 years we should all have learned by now that the opinions of some guy in Southampton can impact on the lives of somebody living in Skibbereen. You know, Brexit has changed the rules of the game, and there are possibilities, given the rather fractured state of British politics, that things could happen in GB politics over the next 10 years that could have a direct influence.
Hello and welcome to this month's Aaron's podcast. I'm Rory Montgomery. Our subject this week is the coverage of Northern Ireland, North-South relations, East-West relations and the diaspora in the media. And I have with me Mark Hennessy, who's the Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times, and his colleague Pat Leahy, who's the political editor of the Irish Times. And the Irish Times has recently launched a project, an initiative called Common Ground. So perhaps, Mark, I can turn to you first, and you can explain, well, first of all, what the initiative is, and then we can come to, you know, what lies behind it.
It's a project that we've been talking about for quite some time in the Irish Times, and largely it is based on a belief that the next decade, we believe, is going to be the most important, probably in a century, in terms of the issues affecting the constitutional shape of the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland and Great Britain. This is not, however, a United Ireland project, because we're not laying prescriptive avenues or anything else like that, but there is an increasing focus on this issue. There's increasing conversation. And in many ways, there is a lack of information. It is very much an elitist conversation amongst the people who are particularly focused on it. And yet you have, at the same time, when people are asked about their opinions on United Ireland for the Aaron's podcast, for instance, 70% of people say that they're in favour of it. Yet when you tease into their understanding of the issues that need to be dealt with, then you find that there's a very thin base, and that's going to have to be improved if we're going to have sensible conversations in the years ahead. And we think we can play a role in creating a space for rational debate, for very cool and calm analysis and discussion of issues. And it has four pillars to it. One is the North-South relationship, defined as broadly as you can imagine, which goes for everything from politics to economics to social affairs to religion to sport, all the things that make up a society. What do we know about each other? What do we not know about each other? What do we not know about each other that we should damn well find out about? And all of those kind of issues are key to what makes us all human beings. Then there are the other three pillars, which will come in and out of focus according to need. One is the East-West relationship, both Belfast and London, Dublin and London. Clearly we're already doing a lot of reporting this area, but by creating a tent for this stuff, we believe we can do more. Then there are issues in Britain that are of importance to us. Scottish independence would be the main one. Will that ever come back on the agenda? The English devolution debate, for instance, not because we're interested in litter collection in Nottingham, but if you have a much more devolved polity in England over the years to come, then that's going to have some impact on the creation of Westminster parliaments and governments, and how could that feed into us? Again, we're covering all of this material already through the GB prism, but by looking at it also with a view, well, what does this mean for us? Then there's added value that can be brought to it. And then finally, the diaspora and the role and influence that the diaspora could play in years to come. And I think that's going to be pretty instrumental in many ways. Last summer I was in the States, and it's quite clear there's a lot of Irish-American money that is available and willing to be spent on social media campaigning that will be done through the prism of Irish America, perhaps to the theme music of the Wolf Tones, but nevertheless it's going to be read in Dingle and Dungiven and places like that. So what people outside the country will do is going to have an impact on what people on the island may or may not think about a whole variety of issues. And then obviously you have the final issue as to, if we were to get into a genuine constitutional debate and preparation for referendum, and that's far from guaranteed, but you know, it's definitely a possibility in the years to come. income, one of the key and central issues that's going to have to be dealt with is who actually has a right to vote. And that's going to be perhaps one of the biggest constitutional issues that we could be faced with in the next 10 or 15 years. And that would happen years before there was ever any prospect of a debate. And the key thing in many ways to remember is that the constitutional issue has an impact even if it never gets pushed to a vote. If people think something could happen 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, whatever a date you want to put on it, if people think of it, then that impacts on the decisions they take about things today or tomorrow. And that's fine for those who are keen on constitutional change, and it's not fine for those who are not keen on it. So just because it may be very far away, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have an impact today, because it very much does.
Yeah, I mean, who are the sort of core members of the Common Ground team? Not even the people, but the functions of those who are contributing to it?
Well, obviously, we're drawing on all of our significant staff resources already. Pat and the colleagues on politics will have very frequent appearances. Our Northern team, in the form of Freya McClements and Seanine Graham, are going to be extremely influential in it as well. And we have a whole cast of opinion formers and columnists. And we're hoping to expand that over a period of time. This is not something we're saying is going to be created in a day or a week. It's going to take time to establish. And in many ways, we're the only media organisation on the island that would be prepared to put significant resources behind something that is, in many ways, a hard sell for, especially for people in the Republic, who in many ways know less about Northern Ireland today than they did in 1998, and in many ways even care less.
I was going to ask the question, to what extent will this actually add value to your existing reporting? But you've kind of sort of half answered that question already.
Well, we think it will, because it's a matter of presenting material in a way whereby you're creating a channel for those who are most interested in it, and then growing that channel. And already in its very short lifespan, we are getting feedback from places that we previously weren't getting feedback. So there is clearly an interest in this, and we'll obviously see how it goes in the future. But you do have a situation where an awful lot of people are coming with very simplistic, unthought out views and opinions. And that's not being personally critical of anybody, because, you know, we all worry about the things that are most close to us in life that we have to deal with. And something like this can feel somewhat airy-fairy for people. But there is a possibility in the years to come, and a probability, that those issues are going to be ones that are going to actually have to be dealt with. And the population on the island and people outside the island need to be properly informed of the kind of challenges that exist. And it's our job to do that in such a way that we're taking quality material and we're presenting it in such a way that we will get the audience for it.
Yes, the aspect of Ireland's work which has attracted the greatest amount of public attention by a long way has been the pair of opinion surveys jointly run by the Irish Times and by Ireland's at the end of 22 and early 23 and end of 23 and early 24. And Pat, you led for the Irish Times on this. With the passage of time, have you any reflections about that experience? You know, what gaps do you think there may have been? What did you find most interesting about the outcomes? What will we need to do in coming years on that question of opinion surveys, which one would hope would be to some degree informed by the kind of work that Mark is talking about?
Yeah, I suppose we came into this, you know, without necessarily any preconceptions, bar one, which was that this is going to be a central question of the politics of the island. The constitutional question, I think, is on the political agenda now in a way that it hasn't been for nearly all the time that I've been covering politics, which is just a little more than two decades. Of course, Mark, is much older than I am, so we've been covering politics for long before.
I'm older than both of you, and I've been reading the Irish Times since before you were born, I'm sure.
But I suppose, given that belief that the question, the constitutional question, and all the issues that surround it, was going to be a central part of our politics, the one preconception we had was that there wasn't a great deal of information reliable, unbiased, objective information about the state of public opinion in North and South on not just the essential question itself, but on all the things that feed into that and create opinions about the central question. And we wanted to investigate that in a non-partisan and objective way. And that is, I suppose, what we've been attempting to do with the colleagues from Aaron's. And I know you've had Brendan O'Leary and John Garry in here to discuss it in the past. And, you know, I think we are still in the early stages of the project. It's been running for 2 years now. It will run again. Later this year. I would hope that it would become a fixture of public debate. And I suppose what we will have to take account of over in designing the surveys and any other, you know, research initiatives that will form part of the project in the coming years is how the question is itself and the debate is itself progressing and maturing and evolving, and how it plays into the politics of both jurisdictions. So, for instance, clearly it will be part of any general election debate that takes place here within the next 12 months. And then on the far side of that election, how these questions and the public attitudes that we have identified in the course of the research play into both that election campaign, but also the construction of the government and any programme for government afterwards. The big question that looms over that, I suppose, is do Sinn Féin play a part in that formation for government? And if so, how that impacts not just on the progress of the debate on Irish unity, but on how it affects the day-to-day politics of the country. So those are the sort of things, I suppose, that we'll be thinking about in the future.
Just to ask you both, I mean, do you have exact figures for, or do you have a general sense of, the consumption of the Irish Times outside this jurisdiction, either outside the Republic, either online or in paper, in the North and in Britain in particular?
Well, we have a significant print audience in Northern Ireland. We no longer have a print edition in the UK, but our GB online subscribers would be quite significant. I mean, I'm not quite sure the percentage, but it's quite a significant percentage. And the interest in these kind of subjects are there. Now, it's not something that engages everybody, I'm not pretending that it does, but the ones that it does engage, it engages very deeply. And that number is increasing. I mean, you know, most people who are in the world of politics can hear the kind of drumbeats going on in the background with Ireland's future on one side, the work that the SDLP are doing on the New Ireland Commission. There's a whole variety of people who are talking about the constitutional debate who wouldn't have been talking about it 5 or 10 years ago. So that audience is there. And equally, you see, you know, kind of major societal shifts taking place on the island, just simply because of the passage of generations. You saw the controversy last year about the Wolf Tones and Ua, the Ra, and how that engaged many generations. And you saw a gulf between people, you know, in their 50s, old enough to remember the Troubles, and people who were in their 20s who have no personal memory of that. And that was quite striking in terms of the sort of gulf that it shows that exists between people, because, you know, to design the future you have to have an understanding of the past. Equally, if your focus on the past is all too obsessive, then you don't get a chance to design the future. So you know, there are significant issues that need to be teased out. And, you know, in terms of the younger generation, they're clearly, because of history and everything else, their knowledge of the Troubles is zero, or close to zero in many cases. But the place that they're talking about is still deeply affected by the trauma of the Troubles. So it mightn't be understood by people in the South, but it's still a real and present factor in the daily lives of hundreds of thousands of people in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, once upon a time, I suppose you would have had reasonable readership in Northern Ireland from, sort of broadly speaking, a kind of educated liberal unionist community.
Still do,
yeah. Mm. Really, yeah. So that's interesting to hear. Yeah.
And I suppose one thing to bear in mind is that that's not just a commercial decision on our part. It's that it's part of the mission of the Irish Times as laid down in our founding documents that the paper should be a newspaper for the whole of Ireland. Now, while quite clearly our overwhelming focus is on the South and on the politics in Dublin, you know, we're the only paper that has, a bureau in Belfast staffed by two very capable journalists in Freya and Seanan there. So it remains a kind of an important perspective, not just coverage of the North for readers in the North, but I suppose maybe more, even more importantly, coverage of the North for our readers in the South and our readers overseas, which make up an increasingly large part of our subscription base.
Yeah, I mean, Mark was talking about younger people and their knowledge or lack of knowledge. And of course, a fundamental issue, I suppose, for all established media, whether paper or online, is getting engagement of young people. So, I mean, have you any idea as to how you might possibly be able to bring the kind of work that you're doing here to a wider, a younger audience
well? We've already had some success in that regard with some of the pieces that we've commissioned in the last while. Younger people aren't going to, in fact, not just younger people, people of all age groups to an extent. If you give them endless quotes of politicians standing outside Stormont on a wet Thursday night, you know, people run away to a very large degree. But there are ways in which you can tell stories. I mean, you have a society that has changed fundamentally in north of the border in the last 30 years in ways that are not recognised and understood by the South. There are loads of positive things that have happened. There are loads of things that haven't moved in any way at all over the last 30 years. So there are ways in which you can tell stories by spending time and money and hours on the ground, getting to reflect the lives of ordinary people and telling major policy questions through the lives of ordinary people. And that is, you know, it's uniquely valuable as a way of doing it, that these things don't need to be academic, they don't need to be dry. We're talking about something that, you know, impacts on daily lives, and there are always ways in which storytelling can be brought to academic research and a whole variety of other subjects that can make these things accessible to people in a reasoned way that is rational, which is unbiased, which is nonpartisan, and which is not trying to dumb down anything. In fact, if anything, it's doing the opposite, but it's trying to do it in an accessible way.
Have you not seen Mark's TikTok dances in which he explains a new dispensation in Stormont?
We haven't quite.
I've been too busy watching.
We haven't quite got that.
I've been too busy watching the next Taoiseach, sorry.
I mean, facetious, of course. But I think it is true that we have the possibility of reaching people, and you know, we're under no illusions that, you know, people under 20 or under 30 are very unlikely to buy physical copies of the newspaper and sit down in a railway station waiting room and read it. But we have ways of reaching them through podcasts, through social media, and that's an increasingly important part of what we are doing, not just in relation to the subjects that we're discussing, but more broadly. And it's something that, you know, we put a lot of thought into in the newspaper, make a lot of effort to do.
I should say, by the way, that we had hoped to have Freya McClements with us, but the timing simply didn't suit. So Pat and Mark are obviously able...
Poor substitutes.
Well, able deputies, I was going to say. And of course, worth noting in the Irish Times, I suppose, that your most regular northern columnist contributor is coming from a, albeit a somewhat quirky unionist perspective, Newton Emerson. But that's an important point.
Yeah.
Because you've actually, if I remember correctly, you've really nobody from a northern nationalist perspective who writes with the same frequency.
We try to represent all sides, but I mean, Newton is a particularly unique voice that manages, I think, to annoy people on every side of the landscape with regular and equal occurrences. There are huge issues that we have to try and tackle in the years ahead. as a society. And, you know, we believe we have a small role in it. I mean, it is very striking when you talk to people down here and you talk in terms of the Aaron's polling of last year. I remember it coming up in conversation with people talking with 70% or thereabouts in favour of unity. And then when people are questioned about, well, how might that work itself out, and what would a referendum look like, and what would be not the numerical number needed for victory, but what number would you need to be confident that the outcome would be one that would be peaceful and happy and content? And, you know, there are some real blind spots in terms of people in the Republic. You know, to the extent that you sometimes hear people saying, well, if Protestants don't like it, then they can go off and go home. You know, kind of, you know, where's home? So all of these kind of things, there's a lot of cheap rhetoric out there that could come back to haunt everybody unless we approach this in a way whereby we challenge all of our biases, because everybody has biases. I've got mine. You know, there are things that we instinctively think are things that we'd be prepared to look at, and things that instinctively we would not. And you know, flags and emblems in some senses are the baby steps along the way. If we think those are the kind of difficulties that we're going to have to overcome, then we're kidding ourselves, because, you know, there's 101 issues. But the most important thing in some ways is the point I made earlier, that the constitutional issue is one that has a relevance today, even if it doesn't happen for decades. If you were to, you know, push forward to next year, Sinn Féin are in coalition, the leading party in coalition, what would happen on day one? The formation of government on day one, the principal item would be unity. People would have voted for them for housing, perhaps, if that's were to be the outcome. But their reason for being, and they've always been completely honest about it, is a united Ireland. That would be the dominant story on the day. You know, Minister for Unity or the Taoiseach talking about the role she would play in such a thing. All of that then has a political dynamic that would be, you know, hugely attractive to people who are in favour of it, and hugely destabilising the people who are not in favour of it. And even if the referendum was to remain 40 years over the horizon, it just wouldn't look like it's 40 years. It would look like it's an awful lot closer. And that then impacts on how people behave today or tomorrow or next year.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, obviously, we've tried to do in Aaron's, the basic purpose of Aaron's has been to promote detailed analysis of issues, some of which are related more directly to the constitutional question, others of which are more kind of cultural, social, economic kind. We actually did, one of our early ones was on the whole question of the franchise in Northern Ireland for a referendum. And then the last one we did before you, if I can give it a plug, was, I thought, an excellent discussion about the subvention, the size of the subvention, the financial transfer. And that was unusually, this was the first time we'd had a former unionist politician, Esmond Burney, actually taking part, along with John Doyle of DCU and Edgar Morgenroth, as a kind of neutral German, I suppose, between the two of them. And so, but that was a real attempt to break down the issue, not to come to conclusions, but to say, well, these are the moving parts, this is the scale of the issue. But obviously we're not under any illusions about how many people we're going to reach directly. So I hope we can provide a useful sort of building block as well. But I think, Pat, it was interesting. I mean, one of the things that accompanied the opinion survey was a couple of focus groups. And leaving aside the specifics, I mean, what struck me very dramatically was that, you know, people would be inclined, you know, would very quickly often offer different opinions than those they had offered in the survey itself. And that, I think, shows how malleable or how flexible people can be.
And this is one of, I suppose, the goals of the research over the longer term, is not just to depict accurately where opinion lies right now. And bear in mind on that point that very many of the people who are involved in a broad sense in this debate are partisans in that debate. They're pushing, they want to see one particular outcome. And obviously in this state, that's an overwhelmingly, coming from an overwhelmingly nationalist perspective. So they are presenting the debate as they see it, you know, with an end in mind. That is self-consciously not where we're coming from on it. We want to be as clear and independent and objective as possible as when we are reporting the state of opinion. But reporting the state of opinion is just one of our is one of our objectives. Also suggesting where that opinion might go, what is driving that opinion, and where it might go, and how it might change in response to changing external circumstances, and how it might change in response to fuller education. So, for instance, one of the things that you would pick up in the Northern surveys is this huge concern about the health service. So we noticed that people from a unionist perspective are much less hostile to the idea of a United Ireland if they think there is going to be an Irish NHS. Now, without going into the much larger issue of what does an Irish NHS look like, what are the relevant successes and failures of health systems north and south? But it is, you know, it's a clearly established case that the health service in the south, by most accepted indicators, is more successful than the health service in the north, not least in terms of treating, you know, more patients to better outcomes, higher life expectancy, and so forth. But the perception in the north, particularly amongst people from a Protestant background, is that the health service in the south is inferior. So amongst the things that we've tried to do, and this was especially the case this year, is to put put these things to survey respondents and say, well, you know, if I introduce the question in a particular way, does that influence your answer to the question? And there, you know, the evidence is mixed. It does in some cases, it doesn't in others. It does in response to, say, the health service, but it doesn't in response to, say, something like flags and emblems, where people's views are much more entrenched and less likely to change.
And that's the key in many ways, that we're trying to present this in ways that will properly interrogate how people feel rather than designing questions to get a particular result. We're not interested in getting a particular result. We're trying to inform our readers on the broad mass of the subject so that they can go away with a proper understanding. And even in terms of the name of the project, you know, Common Ground, we came up with scores of names before we finally settled on this one. And the whole idea about it is to be inclusive and to bring in people of all opinions and none. And also just to make the point that it isn't just, to re-emphasise the point perhaps, it isn't just an all-Ireland project, because we are bringing in large elements of East, West and GB, simply because over the last 10 years we should all have learned by now that the opinions of some guy in Southampton can impact on the lives of somebody living in Skibbereen. You know, Brexit has changed the rules of the game, and there are possibilities, given the rather fractured state of British politics, that things could happen in GB politics over the next 10 years that could have a direct influence on what happens on the island of Ireland, even if we're not the primary targets of it in many ways. So, you know, this is a project with a long reach and a broad reach, but it needs to have that, because this is a complicated subject that isn't just about what the people on the island of Ireland decide or don't decide to do. There are outside factors, all of which we need to have a proper understanding of.
And I think on that, the British focus, or the British pillar, if you like, of the project is a particularly important one, because we know while an Irish government can call for a referendum or a border poll, that it is under the Good Friday Agreement, it's the decision of the British Secretary of State to make. So that obviously depends on the perspectives, but the current perspectives at any given time in Westminster.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I'd be going to ask you about Britain later on, but I'll follow up on that point now then. I mean, clearly, I remember very well that the very distinguished London editor Frank Miller, with whom I had a lot of dealings in my time working on Northern Ireland, and Frank obviously combined this, you know, encyclopedic knowledge of Northern Ireland politics with, you know, great connections in in London. Mm. And it was really interesting the extent to which the London perspective was then valuably, you know, integrated into everything else.
Absolutely.
Do you think it's possible, again, with one journalist in London, to get a broader sense of how things are evolving, you know, not just in today's government, but in opinion more generally in Britain? And I suppose very specifically, you know, we'll probably this time next year, whatever about the Republic, we'll almost certainly, it seems, have a new British government, a new British Prime Minister who knows something about Northern Ireland, and we'll have a new Secretary of State as well. So to what extent do you think you'll be able to capture those kinds of dynamics?
Well, we've spent a lot of time and money on it over the years doing so. And, you know, Mark Paul is our London correspondent and, you know, spends a lot of time talking to people in Westminster, but also outside of it to try and reflect what is happening in Britain. And clearly we have quite a few columnists coming from there. So there is a responsibility not just to keep an eye on and a very close eye on the prominent political narrative of the day, but rather the story behind it. I remember from my own time in London, I remember being at one UKIP conference in Skegness in Lincolnshire, and up to, you know, which, and there are things you want to do in October, but that isn't one of them. But, you know, up to 4 o'clock on the Saturday afternoon, I was the only journalist in the room from anywhere. And it wasn't until Michael White of The Guardian turned up that the press pack increased in size. And, you know, there were a lot of people who were completely dismissive of UKIP. And, you know, they'd never get parliamentary seats, therefore they're not an issue. The issue was not whether they would get parliamentary seats. The issue was whether they would change the dial on political debate in Britain, which they most certainly did. So that kind of work is in some ways best done by an outsider, somebody like Mark Paul, for instance, because a lot of the Westminster lobby is, the British Westminster lobby is completely focused on the Westminster issue. And we saw that most especially during the Scottish referendum 10 years ago now. And, you know, the big guns from London came up in the last week or 10 days, and Nick Robinson of the BBC was been accused of being biased and this, that and the other thing, which in fairness, he wasn't. But what he was lacking was the fact that he hadn't spent a sufficient number of miles on the ground to getting a proper sense of where Scottish public opinion was. And people, there were too many London British journalists who were reporting it with metropolitan attitudes rather than actually seeing what was on the ground. And sometimes you're better off being an outsider to do that kind of work rather than being part of the local press pool.
And you mentioned earlier that you have a two-person bureau in Belfast and two very able people. And RTE, of course, have also got two correspondents or reporters based in Belfast, which others don't. But I mean, Pat spoke about the mission of the Irish Times, but to what extent do your southern readers actually want to, I don't know, eat their porridge each morning? I mean, as working journalists, do you ever find it's difficult to get, you know, stories of this kind into the paper?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be, Pat will give his own views on it, there will always be an internal debate. You know, is the majority of our audience in the South lining up in an orderly queue for us to give them the latest news from Belfast? No, they're not. But there's, you know, the contrary to what people think, you know, journalism isn't just about going chasing cheap headlines. You know, there are times when we make our lives deliberately difficult for ourselves because there are things that we think are important that we believe should be brought before readers, and therefore we bring them before readers. But equally, there's a responsibility on us to try and do this in a way that makes it as accessible as possible for people, that we believe it to be important. And therefore, we have to try and find a way of getting other people to engage with it in the same way. And again, we find, you know, much of the work of Seanan and Freya, when they can get away from the day-to-day of political machinations around Stormont, is reporting on real lives. And if you talk to people and report on real lives and explain the broader policy issues that are illustrated by that, then people will engage no matter where they're from. It's not easy, but it is possible.
I mean, I would say in my experience of doing the North and South project with Arons is that you know, it's readership. The readership numbers were pretty good, actually. We had a lot of interest in that, particularly among overseas readers, but also it metered very well amongst our readers and subscribers. And that, I suppose that's gratifying at one level, but I'm not sure that if it didn't you know, break records that if we that we would be abandoning it, because you know it's not for me to say or for us to say what other, you know, the editorial mix of other publications should be or shouldn't be. But we've got a fairly clear view, I think, in the Irish Times of, you know, the sort of journalism that we want to do. And these sort of projects are smack bang in the middle of that. I think the increasing challenge for us is to package them and present them and channel them towards readers in ways that they find interesting and relevant and informative. And I think if we can do that, that there is an appetite for, you know, for serious journalism that takes work and takes resources and takes commitment and takes us off doing other things that might be more clickbaity, if you like. I was speaking to somebody in government this afternoon, and they were remarking that one of the top stories on both of RTE and The Independent was that the price of the pint was going up again, and he was remarking that this didn't seem to feature in the Irish Times list of top stories. I've just checked our app, and it's still not up there now. I'd like to think that that's a result of editorial choices rather than editorial tardiness. But I suppose we'll see when we see the front page tomorrow.
But maybe the typical Irish Times reader is more a kind of a red wine or a gin and tonic drinker. I don't know.
Whatever
the journalists certainly aren't.
Never about the staff.
Whatever about staff.
But just to Pat, you mentioned politics, and I'm just curious: have you got any reaction? And I don't want you to name names. Have you got any reaction from the political class, broadly defined down here, to, or the North indeed, to this project? How interested are they? And then secondly, I suppose, in general, would it be your sense, and this is going beyond the subject a bit, that there is still a reasonable level of interest in the Southern political class in the North, or has it essentially dwindled away over the last years? But maybe Mark first, yeah.
Well, first of all, there has been an extraordinary amount of interest in it, and I'm around long enough to recognise Plumhouse for Plumhouse. Yeah. So, excluding that element of it, the very large element has been genuine interest and a genuine curiosity about where the project goes. Yeah. So, I think people are giving it a fair wind. I was at a meeting in Ballaghy in Derry the other night with the SDLP's New Ireland Commission, and I was chatting to a lot of the party members who were there outside of the elected reps, and I was struck by the fact that every person I spoke to was aware of Common Ground. Now, their level of knowledge about it was slightly different in some cases, but the fact that even the project had registered with them, as anybody knows, creating a brand name, that's the first challenge. And that has been hugely successful, and we're getting a lot of interest from academics and people who are involved in that broader space. You know, there's a question of extending the audience from here on in, and that's obviously going to be a lot of hard work. But, you know, if you look at the work that people like Jennifer Todd in UCD and Joanne McAvoy have done in Aberdeen, and we're doing some reporting on that at the moment. They've done 5 years of qualitative focus groups, and you get a lot of people coming into the room, and the initial opinions are maybe simplistic in some ways, triumphalist perhaps in other ways, maybe lacking in a great deal of depth. And yet, if you create a structured conversation, very, very quickly, people are into college degree levels of understanding of constitutional nuances and all that. So there is an appetite for this kind of stuff, and it needs to be presented in an accessible way. But if it's done, then we believe that there is an audience, because, you know, the Todd McAvoy work, you know, offers actually great hope for the future, that if you create quality conversations that are done in a structured way, that are not trying to beat people over the head with a predefined outcome, that people will sit back and engage. And most importantly of all, they will begin to start challenging their own thoughts and opinions and hold on to the opinions that stand the test of that analysis. And they appear to be willing to change other elements of it. That is actually quite hopeful.
Yeah, as I mentioned, absolutely. I mean, some of this work was linked to the opinion surveys. And we had a very interesting podcast, in fact, involving Jennifer Todd and then John Doyle, where it was fascinating to see how opinions might either change or become more nuanced or whatever. But Pat, I mean, my question about the appetite for all of this in the Southern political class, leaving Sinn Féin, I suppose, to one side.
Well, I think you can't leave Sinn Féin to one side because clearly they have a very particular perspective on this. And I know that Brendan and John have been in to brief the political parties about the findings of the research. That their meetings that, for perhaps obvious reasons, I've stayed out of. But there's been a lot of interest, particularly interest at the official side as well. People want to know, they want to see the entrails of the research, and I think where we started off this conversation by talking about the fact that this is going to be a central part of our politics for the foreseeable future, you know, then I think the interest in it from the political side and from the official side is perfectly understandable. It would be very peculiar if people weren't interested in it, because whoever is in government is going to have to make decisions in this this particular area, and the more information that they have, and I stress again, what we're trying to do is provide information that is neutral, unbiased, is not aimed at securing an outcome one way or another. The more information that they and, frankly, everybody else have, then I think, you know, the better that debate is likely to be conducted.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, Mark mentioned earlier the the questions which would, and you did too, the questions which will surround any push for a border poll, if Sinn Féin are a leading party in government. There are so many other implications too of a political kind. As you see, the structure of government, the relationships with other political parties. I'm from my own background, I'll be very interested to see what happens to the civil service structures which deal with Northern Ireland as well. I'm not sure I particularly want to be an official in Taoiseach's or Foreign Affairs dealing with Northern Ireland matters. Depending on what my basic instincts were, of course, but it mightn't be easy. Because obviously Sinn Féin, this will be one area where Sinn Féin correctly believes it has an expertise, but that'll be interesting to see. Yeah. So there's a lot to report on over the coming years, even if Sinn Féin aren't in government.
Well, even if Sinn Féin aren't in government, I think the next government, and say if, you know, a some sort of continuation of the present government centred on an alliance of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, plus, maybe with Greens, maybe Independents, whatever. If it doesn't include Sinn Féin, I still think that government is going to have to, you know, be a bit more proactive, it's going to have a policy that goes beyond the current shared island initiative of Micheál Martin. I think it will have to take something to the next level. Quite what that might be, I don't know, but I don't think that it can simply ignore the increasing relevance and centrality of the issue to Irish politics.
I wanted just to raise one final point before we go, or before I ask you if there are any other things you wanted to say. But Mark, you mentioned earlier the sort of diaspora dimension of this and the role, obviously in particular, of Irish America. And of course, there's a Brussels dimension as well, not to be entirely forgotten either. But how do you see yourselves going about that particular bit of the work?
Well, I mean, there's going to be a need for a lot of very much on the ground reporting, because, you know, large elements of Irish America. First of all, Irish America in 2024 is not the Irish America of the 1990s that was so influential in terms of the peace process and Clinton. You know, 30 years on, we haven't had a constant influx of migration from here. Those blood ties and lines are fading. So that's an implication there that we all need to come to terms with in some shape or form. There's a lot of work being done by people like Senator Mark Daly with all of the Senates, state Senates and stuff like that. So which is interesting. We'll see where that goes. But, there is no doubt that Sinn Féin have a reach into the US that no other political party has. They can fill rooms, ballrooms in New York. They will come with a particular perspective, which is one that they've long held, and good luck to them. And that is going to largely influence how Irish America will view matters, which not necessarily how people on the island of Ireland will necessarily view matters in the same way. And there is a danger in some cases of there being an overly simplistic approach on the part of Irish America. Then there is the issue of the Irish in Britain. often seen as one community, but they're not. They're a multitude of different communities, different age groups, different backgrounds, different economic and social histories.
Many of whom, I think we can say, voted for Brexit.
And many of whom voted for Brexit. Yeah, far more than we've ever understood in many ways. And those kind of views are going to be important. There is the right to vote issue that we spoke about earlier, which I think hasn't really been absorbed by the political system here in terms of how problematic that's going to be and how many court challenges and Supreme Court challenges there are going to be years ahead of anything happening, yeah. Or even being decided about whether they're going to happen or not. And then there is the issue of Brussels. You see, you know, going back to the issue of Enda Kenny, first thing he did was to get council to agree that if Ireland did unite, that Northern Ireland would seamlessly come in. You know, that was done on a day when it was perhaps easy to put through, and if he'd come back the following day, it would have been extremely difficult to put it through. So it was a very classy piece of political timing. Whether it'll ever need to be called on is another question, but nevertheless, it is one problem that would be off the agenda. And you have a situation in the north where you have, you know, the increasing growth of three communities, nationalist, unionist, and neither, with the neither category being increasingly vocal everywhere bar the opinion or bar the polling boxes in some cases. You know, you see Alliance being very successful, but Alliance would be far more successful if everybody who put themselves in the neither category actually went out into a polling station and voted. So how does all of that change? And, you know, all of this is set against the backdrop where both parts of the island do not understand each other instinctively. You know, I remember covering the Drumcree years in the 90s. You know, they were very difficult days, horrible in many cases. And I remember the year of the Quins, the three boys being killed in the fire in 98. And I was working with the Examiner and we did a huge package for the Monday edition. And I remember being back in my local pub on the following Friday night. And literally, it was like Livingston coming back from Africa. You know, that reaction that this was someplace that was
so modestly.
Yeah. No, indeed. I will, you know, put aside the modesty. You know, like, it's not often that people actually talk to reporters about what it is that they did last week. And that was something where everybody I met on those particular days were absolutely enthralled and fascinated and horrified by what they... But they saw it as being somewhere foreign, you know? Yeah. And, you know, one of the lines from the meeting in Ballaghy with the SDLP the other night that said to me by a couple of people separately, he said, you know, he said, the problem with you lot, he said that when you come north, you think you're coming to a different country. When we go south, we think we're going to the same one. And there's a great germ of truth in that, in terms of the attitudes of many people in the South, that we've a lot of cheap opinions and a pretty low level of interest. And that is something that we're all going to have to tackle and come to terms with in the years to come, because, you know, these aren't issues that we can ignore. They're going to be part of the politics of the future, and we need to be properly informed on them.
Yeah, Mark, that sounds like an excellent summary and recapitulation of the purpose of the project. Just do either of you have anything to add that we haven't touched on so far?
I'd just say I'd agree with everything that Mark says there. From our point of view, you know, trying to design the next wave of North and South research, I suppose, you know, one of the areas that we'd be really interested in is the one that Mark touched on there. It's the relationship between North and South. And we did a little of this last year about just the lack of contact that many people in North and South have across the border. And it was one of the most striking parts. But I think that's something that we'll pay a bit more attention to. But also this the other element that Mark referred to there is this: the rise of the others or the neithers in Northern Ireland. And, you know, on your constitutional headcount, they're going to be the swing voters. And so how they see the future, how they are likely to respond to foreseeable changes in the north. And, you know, lots of changes are completely unforeseeable, I think, but the demographic change is foreseeable. How that plays out in politics is another matter. And it's, you know, my experience thus far, I suppose, that many of that the middle group, the others, no matter what you call them, one of the unusual things about them is that they decline to see every political issue through the constitutional lens. And I think that will have implications not just in cross-border politics and in the constitutional future, but also in the politics of Northern Ireland. So so I look forward to trying to find out a little bit more about that.
Thank you. Well, Mark Hennessy and Pat Leahy from the Irish Times, thank you so much for coming in today and talking about the Common Ground project. Certainly, as you'd expect, I'm already a keen reader, but I hope that if there are people listening to this who haven't become aware of it, I hope that they will. And all the very best of luck with for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
ARINS stands for Analysing and Researching Ireland, North and South. It's a joint initiative of the Royal Irish Academy, which is the premier all-Ireland scholarly institution, and the University of Notre Dame's Keogh Nocton Institute of Irish Studies, which is itself part of the Keogh School of Global Affairs. It was established in 2020 with the objective, especially at that time in a post-Brexit context, of producing authoritative, independent and non-partisan analysis and research across the full range of relevant constitutional, institutional and social issues. And in fact, over the last couple of years, we've covered a quite remarkable range of subjects, and the research can be found in the Journal of Irish Studies in International Affairs, which is published by the Royal Irish Academy, and access to which is free to all online. The aim is to be scholarly, but also accessible and relevant. Publications began to appear in early 2021, and this podcast also began in 2021 in June. I hope that you've enjoyed the podcast you just listened to, and I also hope that you will find others of interest on our website, which is arinsproject.com, and also that you listen out for future podcasts, which are normally dropped on the first Thursday of every month. Thanks very much for listening.